From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Nobel Week. For scientists, it's like the World Series and Super Bowl Sunday all wrapped into one. Except that in recent years, the excitement has been surrounded by controversy about who does and, importantly, who doesn't end up on the winner's list. This year's Nobel laureates have figured out how to use lasers to hold and cut microscopic objects, how to use the process of evolution to create new versions of everything from biofuels to pharmaceuticals, and how to harness the immune system to fight cancer. Just two of the eight new winners are women, but that's actually more than usual, and there's not a single person of color on the list. There have also been the perennial complaints that an important contributor was overlooked. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has announced changes to the nomination process for next year's prizes, in hopes that they will address some of these issues and concerns. But is it enough? Brian Utsi is the Richard L. Thomas Professor of Leadership and Organizational Change at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. His research has looked at how past knowledge and teamwork translate into future advances and how prestigious prizes affect the trajectory of science. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this year's winners in the natural sciences included two women. That's made a lot of headlines. Donna Strickland is the third woman to win a Nobel Prize in physics, the first woman in 52 years. And in chemistry, Frances Arnold took half the prize and became the fifth woman to win a Nobel in chemistry. Do you see this as progress?
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly making progress in very small steps, but it still has a long way to go. I think there's a couple of different ways to think about it. You know, one is physics used to be a very male-dominated field. And as a consequence, if you simply had more men in the field than women, the probability of a man winning was going to be higher. And in recent years, many more women have gone into physics, but maybe not long enough for all of their work to be appreciated, because it takes a career of research in order to win a Nobel Prize. So I think what we should begin looking at is, where is the progress as men and women begin to reach equal numbers in a field? And then the expectation would be that they should be winning prizes in about equal numbers as well.
Well, that, of course, is one argument, that the underrepresentation of women in the Nobel Prizes is simply a reflection of the underrepresentation of women in science. But there's an alternative explanation or argument that's made that's says that these prizes don't just reflect science. What they reflect is essentially, you know, the good old boys network, the closed networks of power and influence within science. Is there any evidence to support that idea?
Well, you know, in our research, when we look at the determinants of who wins a prize in science, whether it's the Nobel or any of the other hundreds of prizes that are also quite prestigious in the scientific area, we've done everything we could to try to control for people's network connections, kind of the good old boy network. So some of the things that we do, for instance, is we look at how many co-authors a prize winner has and whether their co-authors themselves are prize winners or their advisors are prize winner or how many students they've had in their lab over time. I mean, all of this can create a cheerleading squad that can help move your name to the top of the list and give it a lot of prominence in terms of the review committee's attention to that name.
Well, to that point, I mean, Donna Strickland, the Nobel Prize winner this year in physics, didn't even have a Wikipedia page before she won. Apparently, someone had tried to create a page for her, and a moderator at Wikipedia had denied that request, saying that she hadn't garnered enough coverage elsewhere. And so the only place she showed up in Wikipedia was on her male co-author's website. What does that say to you about not just within these prizes, but the broader state of recognition of women in science and some of these kind of echo chambers or cheerleading groups, as you were just saying?
Yeah, well, I think, more broadly, there is quite a lot of evidence that women have not gotten the level of recognition they should be getting in science. And that's true. And it starts relatively early. There's quite a lot of evidence about this, right from grammar school up through high school, college, et cetera. And that itself has been changing very, very slowly. And I think prizes are one exposition of it. What I think about in prizes, though, is prizes are a particularly important way to look at this problem because it does draw a lot of media attention. And the more attention it gets there, the more likely it is to move the needle in the right direction in bringing parity and recognition. So I kind of see this as a double-edged sword as I've gotten into the research on prizes, that one, it does reflect a continued inequality, but the fact that it's getting attention to me leads to the next step, which is people will begin to want to be much more serious in addressing the problem.
Now, of course, winning a prestigious prize like this can dramatically affect one person's career and one person's standing within science. But what are the ripple effects? Can winning one of these prizes affect the trajectory of a whole field of research?
Well, yes. And, you know, a couple of different things happen there that's really quite interesting in the sense that, you know, we see an overrepresentation of men winning prizes relative to women across all the different fields. And part of that, I think, is driven by women entering the field later, so they haven't had as much time to catch up. There's simply been fewer of them. I think there's underlying discrimination and beliefs about women not being as worthy of it. And then there's also a dynamic among the prizes themselves. Many prizes are prestigious and they lend prestige to the prize winner. But once a prize winner has won a prestigious prize, if they're then selected to be a prize winner of another prize, they give their prestige to the prize. So there's a kind of, you know, positive feedback loop between winning a prize, becoming a prestigious scientist, and then being chosen for another prize because every prize wants to be given out to someone who's already prestigious because it raises the prestige of the prize itself, and then that pattern repeats itself.
There's also a perennial complaint that Nobels are limited to three living individuals and that that can lead to key contributors, living or dead, that may be left out. This year in particular, some of the controversy was around the prize in medicine. But there's also not only concern for that individual or those individuals who may be left out, but also concern that by limiting it to three people, that this could be distorting the whole public perception of science and perpetuating some harmful stereotypes about lone genius scientists. As someone who actually studies the role of collaboration and of teamwork in innovation in science, how problematic do you see that limit as being?
Oh, I think it's a very big problem. And I think different agencies in the scientific world have been trying to address this. So the National Academy of Sciences 2 years ago published a book on team science where one of the main objectives of the book was to try to understand how does one partition credit for ideas and work among people who develop that work as a team. And it's often very hard to do because you're not really in the team observing, you know, who came up with this part of the idea, who came up with another part of the idea. Did you put in 40% of the effort? A teammate put in 20% of the effort. And then if that's the case, how then would you divide a prize? You know, did you get 20% of a Nobel Prize, 40% of the Nobel Prize for an idea? And so figuring out ways in which to put the right boundaries around a team or team effort in regard to the prize is still an open question. I think that the movement from a single person to three people was a very big move for many prizes. And at this point, there may need to be some real reconsideration of a prize that is as enormous and as important as a Nobel Prize in terms of its contributions to science and how much it really can change the world. Maybe three people is no longer enough.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, the group that actually gives out the Nobels, has announced a few changes to the nomination process for this coming year, which will start pretty much any day now. They're encouraging nominators to consider diversity in gender, to consider diversity in geography. They're allowing nominations on three distinct different topics or fields, not just three individuals within one. But given that the nominations have to be kept secret for 50 years, you know, do you think we will be able to even evaluate whether or not these changes make a difference? And do you think they'll go far enough to fix some of the problems that you've noted with the Nobels?
Yeah, so this is also, I think, a good first step, but it's also a very small step. basically the way the Nobel works is they send invitations to different scientists around the world to nominate people who they think are worthy of the prize.
So there's a subjective element even to who gets to make these nominations.
Yes. In fact, I'm not even sure how you get on the list to be a nominator. But basically what happens is one day you get a piece of mail from the Swedish Academy. You open it up really excited, thinking, oh, my God, did I win a prize? And all they're asking you to do is to nominate somebody else.
A little bit of a letdown.
Yeah, just a bit. But nonetheless, that process, we know psychologically, is full with a tremendous amount of biases. So the names that people typically generate are names that happen to be very recent in their memory, rather than looking at what the central tendency someone's contribution has been. So people have made a really recent contribution are more likely to make the list than someone who's made years of contributions, but maybe not a recent one. People tend to search their memory by university, which means they tend to think of the most prestigious universities first, and the less prestigious universities that can have the greatest scientists in the world at them don't even make it into their recall. And so that's a very problematic process. Now, one way to deal with that process psychologically is to remind people to change how they search their memory. And so I think the Swedish Academy is trying to do that. They're trying to take a first step. They're trying to say, hey, you know, think about other geographies, think about subparts of a field that typically don't get attention. So, you know, in economics, market theory, you know, gets lots of attention. Game theory gets lots of attention. But something like labor economics, which is really important for the functioning of the world and people's lives, often doesn't get very much attention. And so that's a good thing to remind people of. The problem is that reminding them to think about gender, reminding them to think about geography, leaves out other things that are probably equally as important. You already mentioned one. Race doesn't appear to be represented properly among the Nobel Prize winners. So, like, unless you add race to that list, people may never think of race. So the list is a nice reminder, but it doesn't really address some of the deeper problems.
Given that, and given all of the different pitfalls that we've talked about, but also the potential benefits. As you've mentioned, when the prizes are done right, they can really boost a deserving individual. They could help counter stereotypes if done well. Are these prestigious prizes like the Nobels worth it? Are they good for science and worth working on? Or is this maybe an idea we just need to get over?
I think prizes are a great idea, actually. One, because they fill that gap in terms of helping us understand what kind of work is really important. Citations are great. You could quantify them. Anybody can look them up on Google Scholar. But prizes draw attention to maybe the best of the best or papers that are kind of sleepers. So they get published. They don't get a lot of citations. But it turns out that, you know, 30 years from now, they really solve a giant problem. And those are the kind of papers that prizes draw attention to. Prizes can also spur on research in a particular area. So what we have observed in some of our research is that once a particular topic within a field wins a prize, you begin to see many more scientists moving into that prize than would be expected if that subfield had never won a prize. So it helps direct attention and coordinate resources and effort to potentially solve a problem and maybe lead to a bigger, even bigger breakthrough. And then, you know, of course, I think prizes are great because, look, they attract media attention. So I think prizes play this very important role in filling some gaps in science. And I think it's really another way in which science connects with, you know, society.
Brian Utsi is the Richard L. Thomas Professor of Leadership and Organizational Change at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
A new UN report explores the ramifications of 1.5 degrees of global warming. How different would that be from 2 or more?
We're talking about bad versus really bad versus catastrophic.
That's coming up after the break. Stay with us.